It's Wednesday, June 25th, 2014, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are colleagues Mike McKean and Jim Flink. On our program this week, a lot of legal news, a decision this morning in the Aereo case, a British court rules in the News of the World phone hacking case, and in Egypt, three Al Jazeera journalists are sentenced to an upwards of a decade in prison. On the political beat, Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill takes Dr. Oz to task, and the New York Times takes a bit of heat themselves for hiring an intern who previously worked for the 2012 Obama campaign. We've got some lighter stuff to talk about, too, like the hottest felon ever. We'll talk about how a mugshot posted to the Stockton, California Police Department's Facebook page drew the attention of millions. It's a pretty jam-packed half hour ahead, but let's start with the Supreme Court decision on the Aereo case, one that could mean the end for that startup. In a 6-3 decision, the court ruled Aereo is equivalent to a cable company, not merely an equipment provider, and to stream broadcast television without compensating the content creators is a violation of copyright. If you'll remember, Aereo provides subscribers with micro antennae that stream live local TV signals to television sets, computers, mobile devices, and so on. So what exactly does this decision mean today?
Well, I mean, basically, it probably means Aereo is going out of business. Certainly, the business model they have can't be sustained. And essentially, what it also says is that the broadcast networks and other producers of content can be protected from somebody who wants to come in with a new technology and distribute their content without paying them back for it. And it's really interesting because the Supreme Court, it seemed to me from reading the decision and the dissent, there wasn't really any disagreement that most of the justices thought that what Aereo was doing, it shouldn't be doing. The question was whether or not there was the right application of the law in making the decision to tell them that they were doing it illegally.
I think it also means that basically the way that business is done right now in the cable and broadcast industry is going to, it will continue to be disrupted in lots of ways that don't center on this case. But at least as regards this case, it protects the sort of fundamental pieces that are in place between cable, dish, satellite, negotiating with networks and that kind of thing.
I mean, the interesting thing to me was that the justices who agreed with the majority were basically saying, as you alluded to, that Aereo is like a cable company. Well, back in the day when cable first came around, it was basically a way to get better signals to remote communities from broadcast television. And when the Supreme Court basically said it was okay for those cable companies to pass along content without paying the producers of it, Congress stepped in and said, oh, no, it's not that way anymore. Cable companies sell advertising. Cable companies determine which channels they're going to carry. And so it's not the same model anymore. Well, the Supreme Court basically said, we agree with that, the majority. They're saying, the Aereo is making money off of this. Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, what's their response? Should the Supreme Court step in or should Congress? And that was the only difference. Basically, Justice Scalia, who wrote for the dissenters, said, I think what they're doing is wrong, too, but Congress should have to deal with this, not the court.
Right. In fact, take it up with Congress. And in fact, that was what will happen. But for now, it doesn't look good for Aereo at all. I mean, this is a company that, some of its chief investors and supporters said, were this decision to come down today as it did, that was the end. That was curtains for Aereo. And it looks like that may be the case.
So how soon might we see this begin to fall apart? Subscribers who are currently using the service, is there some leeway? Is there some time? Or could this be one of these things that even by the end of the day today, by the end of the week, people are without?
We have heard some experts say that, in fact, it could be by the end of the day or by the end of the week. The CEO just came out with a statement that obviously disagreed and felt that there was a lot of technology in play here. I think it will be interesting to say, certainly the core business is now, in effect, illegal. So that means they don't have that part of the business. There are other parts of this business, though, that could spin off, that could evolve into something else. So I would say it depends on which part of the business you're talking about.
Okay. In the fall of 2011, a scandal involving the phone hacking of celebrities, including the members of Britain's royal family, brought down one of the crown jewels in Rupert Murdoch's media empire. the news of the world. Yesterday, that all but became a page in journalism history as former editor Andy Coulson was convicted on a charge of conspiring to criminally hack telephones. Fellow News of the World editor Rebecca Brooks was cleared of the charges against her, as were her husband and three other defendants. How big of a shock was this to have split verdicts in this case?
I mean, it seemed shocking and kind of messy if you think about it. So you have Coulson, who was the deputy, being convicted. You had Brooks, who was his superior and his lover, as it turns out, in the court cases, gets off. And it was Brooks who had all of the political connections. Except, of course, Andy Coulson finally went to work for the prime minister as his sort of image meister.
Which
whatever.
Is kind of a whole other wrench being thrown into this. This is not looking good for David Cameron. A lot of egg on his face.
Yeah, I'm not so sure how much it really affects Cameron. I will say this about Coulson from the testimony apparently in the trial. There were at least a couple of bits of evidence that showed that he was aware that phones were being, or that content was being gotten from the phones of celebrities and others. There was never any direct testimony that Rebecca Brooks actually saw or heard the phone hacking contents. Although if she was the editor and the lover of the guy who was convicted of it, you'd think she probably knew about it too.
Might have known something about it at least, right? I think it is messy for the Murdoch empire, but I think what is remarkable out of all of this is how little damage really was done for the egregious nature of the invasion of privacy that took place. I mean, I think if you're sitting inside Rupert Murdoch's quarters right now, I think you're thinking, we dodged it here. We got away with really one guy taking the fall, and everybody else, you know, there may be some erosion on Rebecca Brooks's career or something like that, but I doubt it. I mean, I think they've survived it.
I mean, the investigation is still going on, and there's some other court matters involving News Corp journalists. So it's not completely over for the Murdochs. But, I mean, look at how easily they got off as a company. I mean, basically what the phone hacking scandal did was hastened a decision they were trying to make anyway to separate their newspapers from their more profitable television and movie companies. They did that, and they're making more money than they ever have.
Well, since December, journalists around the globe have been watching and protesting the arrest of three Al Jazeera English journalists jailed in Egypt on charges of aiding terrorists and endangering national security. They're accused of reporting false news and promoting the Muslim Brotherhood. We're about to play something for you that's a bit tough to take in. Australia's ABC News was with Peter Grista's parents when the sentence came down.
7 years for Peter Grista, repent behooves, and five other six defendants present. My God.
Oh.
My God.
Oh,
sorry.
That's crazy.
Finish.
That's crazy. That's absolutely crazy.
Their emotion and anguish hard to take in there. The ruling draws attention to the Egyptian government's crackdown following the military's removal of the elected president Mohamed Morsi, who was a leader in the Muslim Brotherhood last summer. There was an article in the Columbia Journalism Review that called this trial almost Kafka-esque. What was going on there? What was meant by that?
Well, so, you know, sort of take the classic definition of Kafka-esque, bizarre, nightmarish, illogical, all those words apply. I mean, this was a farce. Any fair-minded person would have to agree. I mean, Amnesty International pointed out, they said the prosecution failed to produce a single shred of evidence. The Guardian, which covered the whole thing, all the hearings, said that witnesses recanted, that the prosecution withheld evidence from the defense attorneys, that Al Jazeera was shown to have basically done what all journalists do, covering multiple sides of the story. And then the prosecutors played these weird taped moments of things that had nothing whatsoever to do with the allegations against Al Jazeera, as if these videos of, like, the pop star Gotye singing some song or some pictures of horses on somebody's cell phone. What did that have to do with anything other than send a very clear and chilling message to them and to the rest of the press?
And I think that is the takeaway. And in fact, that was likely the intent. And now I think journalists have to go into a lot of coverage in war zones and in places where there is huge transition taking place and wonder if this, in fact, could happen to them. It is very much a chilling effect. And I also think that it removes any naivete by any journalist who's traveling internationally internationally to cover conflict, to believe that somehow, to Mike's reference, that fair-minded sort of, that people are looking for justice and fairness, that isn't the case. And I think that's what this verdict shows.
I mean, basically what happened here was that Al Jazeera is based in Qatar. And the Qatari royal family funds Al Jazeera.
Yes. Right.
Qatar and the royal family supported the Muslim Brotherhood and Mohamed Morsi when he was president of Egypt. The current government is punishing them. And a lot of other journalists in the process.
And were it that this were just an isolated incident and it were just that, I think, you know, that's enough. And I agree with you, Mike. I think that the interesting thing is that in all sorts of places all across the globe, what we are seeing happening to journalists is beyond the pale in terms of trying to get a story out and is intended to chill and to eliminate the message.
Well, let's bring it back home. Last week, there was lots of talk about a hearing where celebrity surgeon Dr. Oz met his match in our senator, Missouri's Claire McCaskill. She's the chair of the Consumer Protection Committee. Oz was testifying before that committee on the marketing of so-called miracle weight loss cures. Listen carefully to this clip from The View, which aired last Wednesday on ABC.
Now, Dr. Oz, who is our dear friend and right across from us, will be on the show tomorrow. And he was grilled by Congress yesterday, who accused him of using his show to plug bogus miracle pills for weight loss and health. And here's what he had to say about that. Take a look.
I used flowery language. I used language that was very passionate, but it ended up not being helpful, but incendiary. And it provided fodder for unscrupulous advertisers.
I don't get why you need to say this stuff, because you know it's not true.
I would give my audience the advice I give my family all the time.
I just don't understand why you need to go there.
My job, I feel, on the show is to be a cheerleader for the audience. And when they don't think they have hope, when they don't think they can make it happen, I want to look, and I do look everywhere, including in alternative healing traditions.
You know, it hasn't been all that long since I would be looking up low-fat recipes or trying to find ways to lose weight, and I'd then go onto Facebook and all four ads in the rail would be Dr. Oz's picture promoting some cure, or every afternoon his syndicated show is on promoting some crazy alternative solution, alternative healing tradition, in his words, that kind of leave you shaking your head. Claire McCaskill kind of did that collective head-shaking and then finger-waving for us last week, huh?
Well, and you know, nobody has shown yet that Dr. Oz has personally profited from any of these endorsements of these miracle weight loss treatments, the beans, the whatever. But it's clear that he's using it to promote a connection with the audience on his show. I mean, yes, he's a doctor. Yes, he's a scientist. He's really a TV personality, and that's what matters the most. And good for Senator McCaskill for pointing out the impact for good and for bad that people like him can have.
I think sometimes the popularity of these shows can skew someone's reason in terms of how of what they're doing, and they can get caught up, frankly, in the bright light and the spotlight and the popularity of being on TV and being known and having the money that goes along with that. That having been said, you know, certainly there are a lot of alternative healing methods that maybe should be talked about on shows like Dr. Oz's. This was not one of those situations, and he certainly has lost a great deal of credibility.
The hilarious thing to me, you played this clip from The View,
yeah.
And if you watch the whole thing, which you've got posted
on
our
blog,
you'll also see that afterwards, after they play some of the sort of incriminating or tough questioning, then The View's panelists come back on and talk about how they trust Dr. Oz, and, oh, I've tried the green coffee. And all this stuff. And then they just twist themselves into pretzels trying to defend him and say, why is Congress picking on this guy? They should be picking on the people selling these products. People are selling those products because he is endorsing them.
Well, and the reason that I chose that clip from The View for us to talk about a little bit today was because of something that I had noticed specifically. At the beginning, you heard Whoopi Goldberg say, our friend Dr. Oz will be here to talk about this with us tomorrow. Later in the clip, if you go to our blog and watch it, you hear that again. My on-screen programming guide on my cable box said that on Thursday, Dr. Oz would be on The View. And then it was promoted on The View's website. It was promoted in that clip. And then, mysteriously, Dr. Besser showed up, an ABC correspondent on The View on Thursday, and not Dr. Oz. And there was never any mention of that again. He's been pretty quiet since leaving Capitol Hill.
I imagine he's doing a little damage control. He's trying to figure out how to get back on point, get back on message, and maybe get in the back in the good graces of not just Congress, but maybe many members of his audience.
Well, we'll see, and we'll see when he comes back. He does have that show, is it NY Med or New York Med, starting on ABC this summer, too. Some on the right are giving the New York Times a bit of trouble over one of their new interns. Teddy Schiffler's bio indicates that he's had a few brief stints working for Democratic politicians, including President Obama's reelection campaign. He wrote a story that was published on the Mississippi Republican Senate primary race that some conservative pundits took interest with. Took issue with, I'm sorry. I don't so much want to talk about this story itself, because we can go back and forth on the Mississippi Senate primary forever, but I want to talk a little bit more about this intern's background. And if having worked for a member of the Democratic Party, a politician, should be enough to preclude him from working as a reporter in the future.
Maybe quite to the contrary, having some sort of insider knowledge of how political campaigns and political candidates work, I would think would be an advantage in many newsrooms that might not have that. And in fact, I don't think this is necessarily anything new. There are other reporters that have backgrounds. The big thing is transparency. Transparency saying that that this person has this kind of background and that they bring this kind of background to their coverage so that it's out there in the open.
Yeah, and so now this intern has been, quote, outed, and so I'm sure that if he writes more content for the New York Times, plenty of people will be looking over his shoulder, and that's perfectly okay by me. I will have to say, though, I suspect that when you see, you know, folks like the Red State blogger, you know, saying how terrible this is, it isn't really about this guy or about that story. It's really about the long-held belief among conservatives that there aren't that many people who grown up in Republican politics who maybe wrote speeches for, you know, a Republican candidate, you know, Mitt Romney, for example, who are working as interns at the New York Times or the Washington Post or many of the other mainstream news outlets that cover politics. And, you know, really, if you check into it, you would find, if you look at the political beliefs of journalists, most of them see themselves as progressive.
And in fact, Dylan Byers from Politico just recently did a survey of lots of reporters, and maybe not just political reporters, that 7% identified themselves as Republican, 28% as Democrat, 50% as independent. I think what's interesting is what Mike is saying. You know, there is a preponderance and growing of conservative media outlets that have sort of continued to play this line of the mainstream, the lamestream, whatever the term is, media, painting most media as liberal or progressive or whatever it might be, and it has worked very well for them, both from a bottom line profit line and from building audience, and that will likely continue.
I will say, though, and you said we weren't going to focus on the story, and I'm fine by that, but I did read the story that this intern wrote. Very plain vanilla story about, I don't see what anybody was complaining about.
Well, and even if he does have a Democratic background, work for Democratic candidates, first of all, it's a story about Republicans beating up on each other in a Republican primary. So how does one have to do with the other? And there's also an assumption that's being made there that just because he worked for Democratic politicians, that he's a Democrat himself. Fact of the matter is donkeys and elephants both bleed green. It could have just been a paycheck. We don't know.
I would be surprised.
It's a stretch, perhaps, but it's an assumption.
But even so, I mean, if anybody in our audience wants to read that story and then tell us why they think it's a hatchet job or whatever the word was used against the Republicans, let us know. I don't see it.
Okay. Well, a few weeks ago, we spent a lot of time on this program talking about George Will's column that claimed that on many college campuses, for women who have been victims of sexual assault, it's a coveted status. Well, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch decided to drop Will's column from its weekly lineup. Here's editorial page editor Tony Messenger explaining the decision to CNN's Brian Stelter.
The reaction we had from readers, particularly from women, so many of them were so deeply offended that they could be called that George Will told them that they were trying to somehow seek a special status, that they were trying to seek some privileged status because of their alleged sexual assaults. We had a lot of readers very angry and very hurt, and it caused us to go back and take a look at it. And it reinforced our previous decision that he had lost a little bit of speed off his fastball, and it just caused us to make the decision a little bit more quickly than we would have otherwise.
You even apologized for running the column in the first place. That must be pretty rare.
I don't know that it's ever happened before. It might have. It hasn't happened in my tenure here as the editorial page editor. And the reason for that was we did run it. And so our reaction to it, going back and taking a look and realizing that there was a lot of offensive imagery in that, that victimized women, we had to take responsibility for that. We published it. We wish we wouldn't have.
Lost some speed on his fastball there. You can read Messenger's full letter to readers as it was published in the Post-Dispatch on our links blog at kbia.org. When we first talked about this story a few weeks ago, Mike, you pointed out that George Will was simply doing his job as a columnist there. And one of the things we really talked about was whether or not it was time for the Post to cut ties with Will. At this point, the Post-Dispatch is the only one that's gone ahead and done that.
Well, and let's be clear, I didn't say that I thought Will was just doing his job. That's what his editor said.
Okay.
That Will was just doing his job. I don't defend what George Will said.
Okay.
You can make a defense of the intellectual argument he was trying to make. And if you want to hear George Will's defense,
he's done it himself.
Mm-hmm. He probably is more articulate in defending himself than anybody else is going to be.
Thank you for correcting and clarifying that.
But, I mean, I will say, I mean, the Post-Dispatch so far is the only paper that has refused or has taken him
Has dropped him.
Has dropped him, right? Nobody else has, and certainly the Washington Post hasn't. And my guess is that probably there aren't going to be that many more who do it. So I don't think that Will has any particular reason to be upset beyond dealing with the reaction to the at least inartful, if just not horrible, things that he said.
George Will is not the only columnist, and let's make a separation between columnist and journalist right away here. And he is not the only columnist that has written something in the interest of spurring a conversation about an issue.
Of being provocative.
Of being provocative. And it is, in fact, the thing that sells papers, and it is the reason to have a columnist in the first place. Take away what he's talking about, and in that respect, I understand, as you said, Mike, that he's doing his job. That having been said, this issue of sexual assault, particularly on college campuses such as ours, you know, is something that needs to be taken to a higher level and not dumbed down and really sort of having labels slapped on it about whether it's coveted status or not. And that's the disservice that this kind of tone takes, is that it takes a very complex issue that does have a lot of sub-issues that need to be addressed, and it starts to kind of try to boil it down too simply, and it's not simple.
No, and I would applaud the media here locally and, you know, the university for engaging, being forced into maybe, this conversation about sexual assault on college campuses. It's a good debate to be having and an important one. I will say I am a little bit intrigued by Tony Messenger's reasons that he gave for replacing George Will with Michael Gerson. I mean, he could have just said, it was offensive, our readers were offended by it, it's a pattern of behavior, we're not going to carry this column anymore. But there was this concern that the Post-Dispatch was just going to be seen as being knee-jerk liberal in its response, and it has had a liberal or progressive editorial stance forever and ever. So Tony adds that, well, our audience has told us, both Republicans and Democrats, liberals and conservatives, that they wanted to hear new conservative voices. Well, so my guess is that conservatives would like to hear new and more conservative voices. So they had Charles Krauthammer. They replaced him with George Will. They had George Will. They've now replaced him with Michael Gerson. That's still one voice. Now, there may be other conservatives who appear in the paper, but I'm sure most people, if they read the Post-Dispatch and they are conservatives, would like to see more, not another.
Well, bigger than baseball, with ratings for Sunday's U.S.-Portugal World Cup game tipping in at just more than 24 million viewers, I think it's safe to say World Cup fever has swept the nation. ESPN reports more than 18 million tuned into its main English-language broadcast, an audience bigger than single games of both the World Series and the NBA Finals. And it's expected to draw big again tomorrow when the U.S. takes on Germany. Jim, you're our soccer expert here.
At least a soccer dad. How about
that? Okay, fair enough. outdrawing the World Series. Big surprise there?
Well, maybe not for this particular game. I mean, the fact that the U.S. can take on Portugal and Germany in the beginning stage of the World Cup and be on par with them, in fact, be in a position to beat the likes of the great Ronaldo in Portugal in this kind of a game. No, I don't think that that's a big surprise. There's a lot of, you know, patriotism that goes into all of that. That having been said, it is indicative of the rise of soccer, I believe, in the United States and the fact that, you know, if you go across the state to Sporting Kansas City, they are sold out in that stadium. It is a small stadium. It's about a capacity of 18,000. They're sold
out.
That's
still a lot of people.
They're sold out for every single game. There is little doubt to me that soccer is rising, if for no other reason than every kid, it is their first sport, because every kid can chase after a ball. So it is the first sport, and for many, like my two sons, it becomes their sport.
Well, and I'll tell you, I watched the very tail end of the game on Sunday in all of my years, and we won't get into how many, but it's the first soccer game I've ever watched. So there's an audience that's coming to this for the first time. Do you think there's staying power? Is that going to stick around if the U.S. loses tomorrow?
Well, I think there might be different answers to that questions when it comes to viewership of the rest of this World Cup as opposed to the long term. I mean, ESPN bet on it, and ESPN is the premier broadcast voice of sports. There is money to be made in the growth in interest in soccer. You did have, you know, the U.S. team going up against a team that had Ronaldo, one of the top world players, on it. So some people who didn't even watch soccer a lot probably heard enough or knew enough to say that might be
interesting. They saw the good-looking crying guy and tuned in.
But, you know, after the U.S. managed to pull defeat from the jaws of victory in the last few seconds of that game, let's see what happens after the match tomorrow with Germany. If the U.S. moves on, then there'll probably be some increased some more viewership. If they don't move on to the round of 16, probably you'll see those numbers decline quite a bit.
Okay, quickly, before we go, publishing mugshots, not unusual. Law enforcement does it all the time. In fact, here in Boone County, the sheriff's department does it at 7 o'clock every morning. Well, in Stockton, California, police put them on a Facebook page. And last week, Jeremy Meeks went from accused gang kingpin to the hottest felon alive.
The criminal himself didn't know why he was so popular until I told him.
Well, I appreciate that, but I just want them to know that this is really not me. Like, I'm not some kingpin.
And that is the only reason Meeks agreed to the interview, to tell people his side of the story.
The news media, it hooked their claws in on this one. One photo, and it went off like we've never seen before.
It is a reality of today's media culture that these kind of stories are clickbait. They go viral. They get traffic. They're the water cooler conversation. And in some respects, it's no different than it has been for hundreds of years. That having been said, can we get over good looking versus not good looking?
We can try, but I'm on the other side of the table here.
Right.
Traditional.
Amy says no.
No, we won't. I mean, traditional media have tried to compete against the internet media. How do they do it? By imitating them and putting more internet media on their broadcasts. And I don't think it's served very much of anybody's interest except to go, how low can we go?
Mr. Well, Meeks got his story out,
yes,
too, by
the
did.
Way. Yes, he did. Sorry to have to say we're just about out of time for today. You can read more about the topics we talked about by checking out our links blog under the programs tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @views on KBIA. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again. Leave us comments or questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show, to Austin Federa for handling the audio, and Hope Kerwan, our associate producer. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.